This is West to Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll discuss how the district boundaries are drawn for Congress and the state legislature in Michigan. But first, we remember writer Walter Dean Myers. The best-selling author passed away last week at the age of 76. Last year, Myers, who was the 2012 Ambassador for Young People's Literature, came to Kalamazoo. Before that visit, WMUK's Erlene McMichael spoke with Myers about his work and encouraging young people to read.
It is really quite fascinating that you've become an award-winning writer, and yet your father was an illiterate man, and you actually dropped out of high school. What made you drop out, and what turned it around for you?
What made me drop out was a combination of things. I projected my future, and I didn't see much going for myself. I did not have an appreciation of what being bright meant. I just didn't know. I just didn't see much of a future for myself because my family could not afford to send me to college. That was very clear. My dad was a janitor. My mom cleaned people's apartments. So they couldn't afford to send me to college. And I thought in my 15-year-old wisdom, if I can't go to college, what kind of a chance do I have? And so I dropped out.
You were born in West Virginia, but you were raised in Harlem. And you felt a little bit of embarrassment reading books in front of your peers. You didn't want to be seen with books.
My environment was not particularly book-friendly, as it's not particularly book-friendly today. Very often kids discourage other kids, especially boys. Boys will discourage other boys from reading, and especially in the inner city. So when you have these kids who are discouraged in life generally, they don't want to see other kids particularly succeeding. So it's it comes around to the point in which it creates an atmosphere of not reading. So when I go to juvenile prisons in particular, I see kids who will laugh at other kids who read, although if the book is right, you know, they are interested.
One of the things you did when you were younger, due to this embarrassment, you would go to the library with a paper bag, and you would put the books in a paper bag so that kids wouldn't see it. But you didn't stop, and that says something about you. What should young people draw from your experience that you didn't let this kind of embarrassment stop you and the teasing stop you from pursuing reading?
What kids need very much are role models, the idea of what's really plausible. When you say to a 12-year-old or 11-year-old that reading will do something for you, they might nominally agree, but very often they don't really believe it's going to happen to them. So when I walk into a school and I give kids my background, the kids have read my background, they look at me and they want to say, well, who is this guy? And look, he looks a little bit like us and he has the same kind of background, but clearly he's done well with his life. And many kids will come out and ask me, am I rich? You know, they say, what kind of a car do you drive? Looking for signs of success, because that's the only thing they know. And said, well, if this guy can be successful, maybe I can. I remember going to a school once. A little 9-year-old girl came up to me and said to me after I had spoken, showing them some books, you know, she said, you're not so much. And at first I was thrown, but then I realized that the teacher had built me up, and she was saying to me, you're just like the rest of us. And that is a key thing to me. I want kids to be able to look at me and see that I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth. My parents were not educated people, and yet, through the gifts I had, I succeeded.
Upon your selection as a National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, you talked about that you wanted to focus on low-income minority populations. Have you been doing that in this year and a half?
Yes, I have been. I've been focusing on the lowest income Because what we tend to do is to dismiss these kids. We tend to say, well, they're not reading because they don't have the cognitive skills, or they don't read because their environment does not encourage them, and the environment won't encourage them. Well, you know, some of that is true, but I really believe that we can't afford not to try to bring these kids into the grand American picture. We have to do that. And I think I'm uniquely qualified to do that because of my own background. Whatever these kids are going through, whatever they are going through, I've been down that road. And so I can tell them that.
But I also understand that when you were younger, that you had a speech impediment and that it was due to a teacher who encouraged you to kind of put your thoughts down, that maybe you'd be better able to communicate that way, that led you to kind of writing.
That's true. You mentioned before I was born in West Virginia. Well, I was given to the Dean family to raise. So I was not raised by my biological parents. I was raised by foster parents. So I sort of understand where that thing is going. And I had speech problems for years. I went to speech therapy for 10 years, I think. And people could not understand me sometimes. And that led to a lot of, you know, teasing and fighting and what have you. But when I wasn't playing basketball or some of those sports activity, I stayed home and read. That was my retreat. And that was good. That got me into a world I wanted to be in.
One of the things that you say is that reading is not optional. To not read, it's not an option. What strategies would you give to families to help increase the interest for reading? And what can communities do?
Okay, my mom, my foster mom, could only read at about, I would guess, a third grade level. But she read with me 3 or 4 times a week. What she read was true romance magazines, almost exclusively. And I would sit there with her. And she was not thinking that she was teaching me something. She, you know, it was just a pastime that she liked. And so what I say to people is that you have a gift to give to your child. You don't have to be highly educated, but you have a gift to give to that child. And it's up to you to recognize that. It's up to the communities to recognize that, and that every parent has this gift. What we're trying to do in New York, part of this program with the Every Child a Reader Foundation, is to set up a center in which parents or guardians, sometimes grandparents or what have you, can come and learn to read to their children. And if reading is a wonderful way of spending some time with a child. It doesn't have to be done in long periods of time. If 30 minutes a day, 3 or 4 days a week is wonderful. But that child will become involved in books. And what we need, we have all the research that's necessary. We don't need to bring the research into the public school system as much as we need to bring that research into the communities. And we need to explain to the communities that, no, it's not the school that's that can solve the problem. It's the communities that can solve the problem.
I want to switch gears a little bit right now and talk about your work as an author. You're a children's author, primarily. I know you do some poetry. And our listeners should know that you have won 2 Newbery Honor Awards and 5 Coretta Scott King Awards. So you're really quite a distinguished writer. The themes that you write about has a lot to do with your upbringing. It's about things that affect teenagers in urban settings.
Yeah, I'm writing about my background a lot. One of the things that I want to do is to have young people open books and find themselves in the books. We don't very often write about inner city children. We don't very often write about poor children of any race. Nobody writes about them. So when they pick up a book, they're not going to find themselves. I have nothing against Harry Potter. I have nothing against any of these books that deal with more or less a middle-class population. I have nothing against those books, but you really need to have books which are inclusive of all Americans.
So this is a deliberate strategy on your part to help boost reading or interest in reading for children of color?
It's not a deliberate strategy. It's more or less writing about the things I know about and care about a lot. And I could have made a lot more money writing in a different vein. I could have written more books about white kids and get a larger market. But I said, well, you know, that's fine. That's good. But let me write about the things I know and the things that I would have liked to have read as a kid. You know, I remember as a child, like 14, 15, and my teacher introduced me to Balzac, who I thought was the most wonderful writer that ever lived. And I was thrilled to death to read all of his stories. And then read books by Anatole France and Pierre Loti. That was wonderful. But then I didn't find myself in the books. So when I became discouraged, I just did not find a place for myself in the world. I mentioned this when I met James Baldwin for the first time. And Baldwin said he felt the same way. And Baldwin, who lived not that far from me in Harlem, Baldwin did not find a place for himself. And he left and went to France to live. Richard Wright went to France. You know, I don't want kids going to France. I want people to find themselves in America. And I want white children to read about black children and look at them as complete human beings, not to look at them as only athletes or entertainers and what have you. But basically, you know, I think I'm against the idea of I have a strategy to do this. I think basically I write because I love it. You know, I love writing. I get up every morning anxious to get to my computer. And I write fast enough, and I have been as successful as I have been, so I have options, you know.
Despite the very gritty and the really tough topics that you deal with in your books, there's a sense of hope. Is that important?
You have to give kids a sense of hope and a sense that they can rise above their circumstances. One of the things that I want to say to young people, that although your circumstances might not be ideal, and they often are far from ideal, if you talk to some of the thousands of kids I've spoken to, people who with similar backgrounds do well, and it's not always the college education that you need. Or you don't have to finish college at 20 or 21. You can do things at your own pace, at your own level, but you have to believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, it's going to be difficult.
Why is it important that young people read? You say as you've gone out there, you've kind of found that some kids wonder why should they read? You know, they don't see how this applies. How's this going to make them successful ultimately?
Okay, right. Which is why I say to them, reading is not optional. Reading is not optional. And we allow kids to believe that sometimes. When we say things like, books can take you to faraway places, and a book is like a frigate, I think one writer said. And that suggests to me that, okay, all you have to say is, I don't want to go to faraway places, or I don't want to read about Harry Potter's world, and it's fine. It's not fine, because you have to be able to read to survive in this country. And one of the things that I discussed in the book, All the Right Stuff, is that there is a social contract in existence. Whether you want to deal with it or not is totally immaterial. You have to deal with the social contract. And the social contract says that in our society, there are skills needed to succeed. And that what we will continue to do, because we appreciate these skills, is to structure the society so that reading is important, so that high school graduation is important. And you have to recognize that. You don't have a choice. It's like playing in the NFL and saying, well, I'm not a physical person, but I'll play. No, you won't.
My understanding is you also tackle a lot of historical topics in some of your books.
I'm so interested in history. It's just fascinating to me to, for example, now I'm working on a book on flyers, black flyers, and how many women flew back in the 30s. That's just fascinating. I mean, once you discover that, you really have to bring that history to young people and to say to them, look, this is who you are as much as some civil rights person.
Sounds like you're filling in some information gaps for young people knowledge gaps.
One of the things that I've been working on over the last 2 years, maybe 3 years, is the idea that when people don't read, they have create not only a language gap, which is clearly recognizable and which holds them back in life, but there's a knowledge gap that's stunning. It's so stunning that kids don't know anything about stuff that happened within the last 50 years. I am stunned when I talk to kids and they'll ask me questions like, when the Vietnam War happened, how did your brother get there? Did he take a bus? Did he take a bus? Do you know where? They don't know where Vietnam is. They can't find it on a map. And these things hurt kids. They have a limited understanding. They have a limited understanding of what's going on around them. And that stops them. That stops individuals.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the author Baldwin that you had right down your block there.
Baldwin was, his father was a minister and what have you, and when they did not have a good relationship. But Baldwin looked for a way. He liked language, and he did not want to be labeled simply a black person. He wanted to, because he was a reader, he wanted to be labeled an intellectual and a writer. And that was wonderful. But then in his reading, he told me that he'd never encountered himself in all the literature that he was being exposed to. So when he began writing, putting his own community, not all the time, of course, but in his books. So when I first read the first short story that I read of his was a story called Sonny's Blues, and it was about a young man struggling with a drug addiction. But wow, that moved me because it was in my neighborhood. This is my neighborhood. He's talking about my streets, and I devoured that story. I read the story over and over again. And, so when I finally met him, I said, that was the greatest story of my life.
How old were you when you met Baldwin? And how old was him?
He was about 12, 14 years older than me. I guess I was about 30.
Sounds like he was very receptive to you as another writer.
Because I was introduced to him by another writer, a novelist, John Killens, who wrote And Then We Heard the Thunder. Black writers, they look at each other and they have a kinship. When I was a very young kid, Langston Hughes came to my church to read. At that time, they did not sell many black books in bookstores. And so people would do the church things. You would go into a church with a suitcase full of books and sell them at night, which was kind of cute. But I wasn't interested in Langston Hughes because he was quite a bit older than I was. And he turned out to be a great guy because he helped us when I was in my 20s. Langston Hughes helped the group I was with then to put together a magazine. So,
Thank you for joining me today on WMUK.
Thanks for having me.
WMUK's Erlene McMichael spoke with author Walter Dean Myers last year before the Ambassador for Young People's Literature visited Kalamazoo. Myers died last week. He was 76 years old.